Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 05-3171, United States of America versus Cornell. Ms. Dyer, the appellant, Mr. Grant, for the appellate.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Beverly Dyer on behalf of Rennell Holmes, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The government agrees in this case that police officers seized Mr. Holmes' keys from his pocket in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Mr. Holmes never would have admitted that he had a car parked nearby had the officers not confronted him with a car key that they took from his pocket illegally. Discovery of the car key led directly to discovery of the car and then to the gun in a matter of minutes. This court should suppress the gun as the fruit of the illegal seizure of the keys because there was no intervening event in this case that broke the direct causal chain. And there was no response sufficiently, I'm quoting from Wong Sung here, sufficiently an act of free will to purge the primary taint of the unlawful invasion.
Why isn't signing the consent form?
Consent does not purge the taint of the officer's illegal actions, as the Supreme Court held in Florida v. Royer, and as it held with respect to confessions in Brown v. Illinois, and in Dunaway v. New York, and in Taylor v. Alabama. Advice of the right to refuse consent, just like signing the form, is simply a matter that goes to voluntariness, which is not the issue before the court once there is an illegal seizure that precedes the consent. Any other result would reduce the constitutional violation to, as the Supreme Court has said, a mere form of words. Neither consent, nor the advice of the right to refuse, nor a signature on a consent is enough to protect the Fourth Amendment's exclusionary rule here, or to deter officers from violating the Fourth Amendment if it is that easy to cure a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
So what do you think is required?
I think what this court needs to look at is the causal chain of events under Wong Sung, and whether there is any kind of break in that causal chain, which the consent is not sufficient to suffice as, that would it's a matter of the directness of the causal chain. I think that the Brown v. Illinois factors that many courts have cited are relevant, but they are not the only considerations. I think that the primary thing this court needs to look at is whether one event led directly to the other and whether anything stopped that chain. Of the nature courts have described, things like appearing before an independent judicial officer like a magistrate, or time out to consult with client's lawyers, or a release from custody for a matter of days. Those are the types of events that break the causal chain in the cases that courts have considered in the past. And though there are some circuit opinions which the government cites, finding that advice of the right to refuse consent is enough, I think those cases are wrongly decided.
Where are they from?
I think that's clear from...
Where are those cases from?
There are cases from Iowa, which is State v. Lane. That case cites that as one factor amongst many. There is Height, which is from New Hampshire, from the state of New Hampshire. And there are several others that do include some circuit cases. Misplaced my list of cases. Kelly and
U.S. v. Kelly in the Fifth Circuit.
Well, in Kelly, there was the consent was given by the passenger and not by the defendant. I'm not sure that should be the deciding factor, but I'm sorry, say that again.
I didn't think that was the court's rationale.
Well, I think the court did rely on the right to refuse consent, and I think that that's wrongly decided.
Okay, I wanted to establish that. You disagree with that?
Yes.
Is it even relevant, as in Perry?
I think it could, well, I think the issue of voluntariness is, to some degree, relevant, but it's certainly not conclusive. And I think it's certainly relevant to voluntariness. So yes, I think it's a factor, but a minor factor. The form is the same, of the nature of the same type of consideration or factor in this case as well. But the government seems to rely on some long procedure that happened in order to obtain Mr. Holmes's consent. Here, the record only shows that the officers read the form to him out loud. It does not show that they gave him sufficient time to read it to himself before taking his handcuffs off and obtaining his signature. In addition, there are so many other coercive factors at issue here. He was in handcuffs the entire time. The officers were claiming that they could arrest him for rolling papers, and they linked that claim that they could arrest him to rolling papers to obtaining consent. They discussed those in the same breath, according to Officer Green, and that's on in the record on pages, I think, 84 to 85. They held him beyond once a warrant check, a Wales check, had come back negative for any warrants to hold him, beyond when they had found no evidence of weapons on his person. Rolling papers are not sufficient to hold him that long. They continued badgering him with questions because they didn't like his responses to...
That's how they were all wrong, right?
Excuse me?
All the responses were evasive.
Well, I don't know what's evasive.
Apparently the police thought they were unconvincing.
Well, the police didn't like the answers that they got. I don't know that they were...
That didn't make a lot of sense.
Well, there's no reason he couldn't have arrived in D.C. on Metro or that a friend couldn't have dropped him off. Had the officers not waved the car keys in his face or at least said, why are you carrying car keys? How come, you know, that doesn't jibe with your explanation that a friend dropped you off, he never would have told them that he had a car. He was attempting to not tell them that he had a car, but they didn't like the answers that he gave them, so they kept questioning him. In the circumstance,
the district court said that the officer's knowledge that Holmes had a car key, had car keys, was not dependent on having the keys in his hand, but rather on having felt the keys in his pocket. Right? That's what the district court found.
The district court seemed to equate feeling the keys in the pocket.
So, well, let me ask you this. What do you think our standard of review is here?
I don't think that this, well, I think that it's a de novo standard whether or not it's a clearly erroneous standard whether or not the officer could actually detect car keys through the pocket.
Okay, and so we review this sentence I just read you from the district court for clear, right?
I don't think that that's a fact.
You don't think so?
I don't know that the court, in making that judgment, made a factual finding that the officer could actually feel car keys through the pocket, as opposed to some other kind of key. There's nothing in the record to support.
But what else could he have meant? I mean, he says the officer's knowledge that Holmes had car keys, that's what he says, was not dependent on him having them in his hands, but on the fact that he felt them.
Yes. And in that case, this court needs to apply a clearly erroneous standard of review.
When we come to the ultimate decision here, is this a constitutional error as to which there's been a confession of error and the government would have to show it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? Or is the, at what point does the error come in here and what is our standard of review?
Does the clearly erroneous factual finding come in?
Pardon?
That's a very interesting question.
You're appealing
yes.
from a decision that's by the right. district court mm-hmm. that says that this is not the result of a tainted search.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
All right. Is that a constitutional decision?
Yes.
As to which the government would have the burden for showing it's harmless beyond reasonable doubt if it's based on an erroneous decision, or do we go back all the way to the factual decision and apply simply a...
Well, the same standard would apply to a factual decision, to a clearly erroneous factual finding that it would have to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I have not thought about the Chapman standard as applied to search and seizure cases because the Ornelas standard is so plainly laid out. But I think the court is correct. It is certainly
neither
a constitutional
brief
error.
Neither lays out very much at all on standard of review. And very often on closed cases, standard of review can be the deciding standard.
Well, that's very true.
Before we get to the, don't we first have to decide whether there's a constitutional error here? I mean, the government's confessed that the seizure of the keys violated the Fourth Amendment, but the government's arguing, let's assume for a minute that the government's right, that the taint of that seizure has been eviscerated through some method, either because of the form or that it's too attenuated or that it's not the but-for cause, then we wouldn't get to that question, would we? We first have to make this decision.
You first have to make the decision about whether the officer could actually feel car keys.
Exactly.
There's nothing in the record to support a finding, to support the district court's conclusion that the officer could detect car keys.
So you'd say that's clearly erroneous because the most he could have done is felt keys. But I suppose the district court probably thought that, well, you know, they were already suspicious about how he got here, right? And so it might have been natural for them, if they didn't have the keys in their hands, to say, well, why do you have keys in your pocket?
That's not the question, according to the record, that they asked. They asked, why are you carrying these car keys?
Yeah, but that's because they had the keys in his hand.
Well,
right.
That's correct. I just lost a thought. I'm sorry. Are you asking a question? I'm sorry.
Nope. I'll just state, I mean, I guess what one might argue, maybe when the government stands up here, it will say, look, even if the officers didn't have the keys in their hand, they knew he had keys in his pocket. And because of their suspicion about how he got there, it's reasonable to think what they would have said is, well, if someone dropped you off, why do you have keys in your pocket?
I'm sorry, this was going to be my response.
Yeah.
In order to make that showing, the government would have had to show inevitable discovery below. They did not make that showing. There's nothing in the record to support a finding that the officers would have continued questioning him about how he got there and about whether or not he drove, leading to a confession on his part that he drove, had they not had the car keys in their hand and gone to. And that, I think, is a factual finding, and it requires a showing based on proof that the government hasn't made. Below.
What I want to know is when the district court made the statement in question here, was the issue how could you know there were car keys?
The issue that was raised to the district court, and if the court's I believe the defense attorney said the difference is now that having removed the keys from his office, and he's just said, well, before they get there, they remove his keys. They've illegally seized his keys. And then they interrogate him as to what he's doing in the area. And then later he says, at the bottom of page 120 to 121, he says the only reason the officer can sort of impeach him with is, well, I know that you have car keys. So that was the issue before the court. And at that point, the court says,
where are you?
Pages 120 to 121 in the transcript, the suppression transcript.
All right, so this is counsel speaking.
This is counsel speaking.
Mr. Holmes basically says, I came to the area, I was dropped off. The only reason why the officer can sort of impeach him with is, well, I know that you have car keys. Court, that's not true. I know that you have car keys, that's fine, but the officer's knowledge that he had car keys was not dependent on the officer having the keys in his hand, but rather dependent on the officer having felt the keys in the course of the pat-down.
Well, that is a clearly erroneous factual finding by the court.
Why?
There's nothing in the record.
Some other kind of keys.
There is nothing in the record to support the finding that having patted him down, felt keys, that he could detect that there were car keys.
Suppose he just back away from these facts for a second. Suppose the officer pats him down, feels the keys, and takes a lucky guess and says, why do you have car keys in the car?
But that's not what the record suggests.
I understand that.
If the officer had done that, and if that had been the course of the interrogation.
He's arguing that he was tricked.
We might have framed this case more along an extension of the Terry stop beyond where the officer could have, should have let him go in badgering with questions in order to extend the Terry stop. So I think that, we would have framed our argument differently if that were the record supported that finding. If the court has no further questions.
May it please the court, Stratton Strand on behalf of the government. If I may, I'd like to address the two issues that appellant has raised thus far, the issue of whether the finding of the gun was in fact the fruit of the illegal seizure of the keys, and secondly, whether even if there was some taint, that taint was sufficiently attenuated by appellant's voluntary consent.
Right where we are now.
Okay, I'd be happy to.
Okay, before we lose the thread. Okay. There's nothing in the record to suggest that that they were car keys, right? Before the officer seized them.
Respectfully, we believe there is, Your Honor, and we, as an initial matter, we do agree that this is a factual finding by the district court that's reviewed under a clearly erroneous standard. We believe that Nix versus Williams, the Supreme Court case, makes clear that this type of determination, what would have happened if something else hadn't happened, is your classic factual determination. The evidence in the record suggesting that the officer could, through plain touch, identify these keys as car keys was as follows. The testimony was that the officer could feel keys, plural. The keys were on a, quote, key ring.
I thought he testified that they felt like keys. Didn't he?
Didn't he say they felt like keys?
At page 81 of the transcript, they felt like keys.
Felt like keys.
Yeah.
He wasn't saying they were keys. He said there was something in his pocket that felt like keys. So he has to make, he has to have made two steps to have reached your conclusion. Number one, he had to conclude that what felt like keys were in fact keys, and that number two, that they included a car key on them, right?
Rational inferences, which are specifically officers are specifically allowed to make under Terry. There's also evidence in the record
that
a wild bird there about rational inferences.
What does that mean?
I mean, it's probably a true statement, but what does it have to do with what you're being asked about?
Well, if I may,
as Judge Tatel posited, that he had to first say, those are keys. Then one of them's a car key. And you're basing it on a record that says something that seemed like keys.
Well, if I may, I apologize for not answering that question as directly as you would have liked, Your Honor. The way it came up was the defense counsel asked the question, did you feel something that felt like keys? And I believe the answer was yes. Okay. So it's not absolutely clear cut that he's saying it only felt keys.
But look at the question this way. I understand that somebody could rationally think that what was in his pocket had a car key on. But the question I think Judge Santel asked you was, or Judge Ginsburg did, was what evidence in the record supports that other than the officer's inference?
We also know from the record, Your Honor, that the key ring that these keys, plural, were on contained an electronic opener.
Do we know that the officer could feel that through the extended pat-down that he did?
We don't have to know that, Your Honor.
Yes, you do.
I apologize.
Don't tell me something that isn't an answer to my question.
Well, Your Honor, if I may answer your question, you asked,
do we know
for sure that he could feel that?
Do we have anything in the record that indicates that he had any idea what those keys were on before he got them out unlawfully by your concession and looked at them?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where? What page?
It is on pages 67 and 68 of the transcript. Where Officer Green, who once he removed the keys, used the fob to locate the car. Okay, so we know that the key ring included a fob. And the question here.
What I'm still asking you is, what do you have in the record that says he could tell that before he got him out of the man's pocket?
What we have is the trial judge's determination.
No, huh? You've got to show me something before that. The trial judge can't make a determination except on what are the facts. You've already conceded that this was an error to hold that the seizure of the keys was lawful. Now, you've got to give me something in the record before the trial judge's determination. You have to have some evidence.
With respect to Your Honor, I believe the question here is, was there evidence in the record to support the trial judge's finding that the officer could, in fact, identify these as keys? And what I'm trying to cite to Your Honors is evidence supporting the trial judge's finding.
Yeah, now, and we're still asking.
And the evidence that I'm aware of, Your Honor, is threefold. One, that they were keys, plural. Two, that they were on a key ring. And three, and most importantly, that they included a fob.
Where do you have a page, a sentence in the record that says any of that?
Pages 67 and 68.
I've got 67 in
front. Okay, and that's where he used the fob.
So, all right, he used the fob after he got them out.
And my
I'm
suggestion
trying
is
to ask you if you have any evidence, and your answer may be no, but please give me that answer.
My suggestion is that the trial judge appears to have assumed that he could tell, given the configuration of the keys and the fact that it included a fob, that he could, in fact, identify those as keys.
I think
I
can tell that you don't have an answer to my question.
Your Honor, if your question...
You, and Judge Tatel has asked you for something in the way of evidence in the record that says he could tell that.
Okay, if
never
your question,
mind what the trial judge may have assumed.
If your question, Your Honor, is do we have testimony from Officer Green where he specifically says, I know that those are keys.
What my question is.
Okay.
My question is, do you have any evidence in the record to support the proposition that he could tell there was a car key or a fob, if you want to, in that man's pocket before he took it out?
Your Honor, I'm afraid that my answer does not change. My answer is yes, that there are three pieces of evidence that support the trial judge's determination.
The first was, after he had it out, he said he had a fob.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's after he had it out.
Yes, Your
Honor. I'm still looking for evidence before he took it out.
Your Honor, there is no testimony in the record from Officer Green
or anybody else
that I could tell that those were car keys. That is correct, Your Honor.
Lose the phrase "officer from Officer Green." There's no evidence in the record that Officer Green could tell that this was car keys before he took it out.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The three items of evidence.
Disagree and tell me where that evidence is. Tell me again what he said about the fob after he had him out. Forget that one. That doesn't work.
I can't.
What are the other two pieces of evidence?
I can't give you any more evidence than I've already provided. And if that's the answer to your question.
As to him telling it's car keys before he got him out.
No, I'm not prepared to concede that, Your Honor.
Then what is the evidence that he had that knowledge before he got him out? That he could tell that before he got him out. Don't tell me about something that happens after he got the keys out. Is there some evidence in here that you haven't pointed to yet about him knowing these are car keys before he got them out?
Not that I have not pointed out thus far, Your Honor.
Which
now,
is no.
If I may, Judge Tatel pointed out in an earlier question to appellant's counsel that let's suppose that Judge Bates's factual finding here did not in fact include an assumption that the officer could actually identify the keys as car keys at the time he felt them. Judge Bates's ruling is not entirely explicit as to whether he makes that assumption or not.
Well, he must have. I mean, there's no other way he could have made that finding.
Well, I believe that Justice Ginsburg pointed out the issue wasn't actually raised to him by appellant's counsel or by anybody. Well, how could Officer Green actually tell that these were car keys? Judge Bates appears to assume that if he said
the officers. If he said that the officer's knowledge that he had car keys was dependent on the officer having felt the keys, so he must have made that assumption. There's no other way he could have said that.
Well, I believe another fair reading of that statement would be that Judge Bates assumed that having felt that there were some type of keys in the pocket, that the officers would in fact have had a basis just on that knowledge to challenge the appellant, and under the circumstances of this case,
they wouldn't have challenged the appellant unless they had thought that the keys were car keys.
As you yourself suggested in one of your questions to my opponent, the police could very well have made an educated guess and said.
No, but I wasn't suggesting that was my view. I was suggesting that's what I thought you might argue when you stood up here.
Well, you were prescient because that is, in fact, our position. It's not a necessary inference here. that the officer could tell that they were car keys.
But why would the officer care about the keys if the officer didn't think they had a car key on them?
Well, if, and this brings us to the, an essential point. The whole question, the line of questioning, how did you come to this area, had nothing to do with the car keys. The,
right.
That question arose when Officer De La Rotary was filling out the PD 76 form. Both officers testified that it was when they got to the address information that they learned that appellant was from Maryland. And it was at that point that they started asking him, how did you get here? What happened next? What happened next was appellant gave a facially implausible answer. He said, well, I took the metro.
Well, let's just move along to the end of it. I mean, what precipitated him saying, I have a car, was they said to him, well, why do you have these car keys? That's where they ended up, correct?
That was the last question.
Yeah, so...
And our argument
so,
is...
So the car keys clearly played a role of some kind.
They played a role of some
his
kind.
His admission that he had a car.
They played a role of some kind, but that's not the end of the inquiry under a fruit analysis.
Okay, that's what I wanted to ask you about. You say on page 33 of your brief, you have this statement. Nothing in the record suggests that had Officer Green not seized the keys, he would not have asked appellant about them.
Yes, Your Honor, this is
so
my point.
I take it that's your... Now, how would the defendant ever... Explain that, what that sentence means to me. Explain what in the record would possibly suggest that had he not seized the keys, he would not have asked appellant about them. How does that work?
The officers did not believe the explanations they were getting. The first, if I can just go through the sequence of events very quickly.
Well,
I
why don't
think
you just explain that sentence to me?
I'm trying, Your Honor. Uh-huh. The officers ask him, how did you come here? He said, I took the metro. They did not believe that, given the lateness of the hour. And then he quickly changed his story. Oh, yeah, a friend dropped me off. Now they've got not only a facially implausible answer, but a changed story. They, at that point, their suspicions are heightened even further. They don't believe him. They say, oh, yeah, well, why do you have these car keys? There's every reason to believe and no reason to doubt that even if they hadn't had the car keys and even if they hadn't known from the plain feel that the keys were car keys, that the officer would have asked the same question,
why do you have
keys in your pocket?
That's not the standard that you articulate in your brief.
Well, I'm sorry.
That's not the same thing you say at page 33, but... Even if that is now your standard, how do you know that? How do we know that the officer would have gone ahead and asked that question anyway?
Essentially,
what you're doing is you're saying the government's conceded that this was a constitutional violation, right? But that it can be admitted anyway because we can speculate that the police officers, based on what they knew, would have. Had they not had the keys, they would have said, well, why do you have car keys in your pocket?
Correct, Your Honor. And if I think the central point here is it's not for that is initially a determination made by the trial court. And so our function here is mm-hmm. to ascertain, was there evidence in the record to support the trial court's determination that the officers would have gotten appellant to fess up one way or another? And there is sufficient evidence in this record to support the trial court's factual determination on that point.
You're making an inevitable discovery argument, right?
You know, these doctrines are all kind of mushy. Inevitable discovery, independent source, but for, they're all...
Well, inevitable, I don't think you've got an independent source. Maybe you do, but...
It's kind of hard to tell.
Insofar as you're making an inevitable discovery argument...
Yes, Your Honor.
The law is pretty well established that you can't go on speculative elements, that you have to have...
objective facts.
Yeah.
Objectively verifiable facts.
Objective and verifiable facts. And when you back yourself out in the beginning to a double negative to get there, there's no evidence that they would not have found it. That's pretty far from giving us objective facts of inevitability, isn't it? I mean, that pushes the burden. That doesn't just shift it. It pushes it off the edge of the other side to say that you win because there's no evidence that they would not have found it.
At the outset, Your Honor, the inevitable discovery doctrine, a determination of inevitable discovery is also a factual determination made by the trial court. So, again, the focus here is the trial court made an inevitable discovery determination.
At the outset, all of review of factual
determinations
is based on the evidence in the record.
Of course, Your Honor.
And your burden when you're talking about inevitable discovery. That's not a simple fact finding. That's one where you have case law that says that you can't use speculation, that you have to have verifiable objective.
And we submit
it's not just simple fact finding like what date this occurred on or something. It has constitutional significance, and the law has been imposed a burden on the government.
Absolutely. And that burden is a burden of showing by a preponderance of the evidence. And we submit that the evidence in this record was sufficient for the trial court to make the determination that the government had proved by a preponderance of the evidence inevitable discovery. And the evidence, the objective evidence that we have in the record, is that the officers were going down this line of questioning already. The appellant had already proved himself to be a terrible liar. He'd proved himself to be unable to stick to any consistent story.
He might have been a better liar if they hadn't shook his keys in his face that they took out of his pocket. And
you've got
to prove that inevitably he would have been just as bad a liar if they had.
Another point here is how strong the impeachment value of those keys was.
The officer used them.
You're going to have a hard time getting around those keys.
You've confessed error on them, and your evidence is that the officer took them out and used them in this question.
And that's only the first step in the taint analysis, however, Your Honor. The question then is whether there's a sufficient connection to require exclusion.
We don't, in fact, here have a
but-for fruit causation.
Let's go. You started talking about the steps in the taint in the analysis here. Let me see if we understand what those steps are. The first step's resolved, right?
Sorry?
The first step is taken care of by the government's concession.
Correct?
The first step in the analysis. Isn't that what you were about to get into?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the second question is there a taint?
Correct.
The third question is, was it dispelled in some way, right?
Is there attenuation? Yes.
Yeah. I understood you originally saying that even the second step hasn't been satisfied here because of the district court's finding that the officer's questioning wasn't dependent on having the keys.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
The government's theory, the burden never shifts to the government at all, right?
No. The government had the burden at the hearing of proving by preponderance of the evidence that the same result would have obtained. And the trial judge found that the government satisfied that burden.
The second step is the question of was there a taint?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, the defendant has the burden there, right? To show some taint. Isn't that right? That is, to show that the keys somehow affected the discovery of the car.
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
You're not sure of what?
I'm not sure who has the burden on that. I believe that where you have a confessed illegality, the burden at that point is on the government to show that the evidence nonetheless should come in.
Let's set aside the burden. You think that this statement shows there was no taint, correct?
Which statement?
The district court statement.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but then why do you insist on, in your answer to Judge Sintel, going on to inevitable discovery? If the keys in his hand didn't taint anything because his knowledge was based on what he felt in the pocket, why isn't your theory that ends the case right there?
It does end the case, and that's why I try to suggest in my answer to Judge Sintel that these concepts, inevitable discovery, taint, inevitable discovery, as I understand it, is a taint concept. That's why I answered the question
the way
I did.
Suppose we think there's no evidence to support this statement of the district court, and we conclude that there is a taint, that the keys played a role, a causal connection to the discovery of the car. Then what?
I would like to answer the question. I will immediately, but with one preface.
Go ahead.
Forget the preface. I go straight to the answer. Then we're into attenuation analysis. And the question there is, why did appellants informed voluntary consent? Why was that not sufficiently an act of free will to purge the taint? We believe that it was. In Brown, the Supreme Court case that both parties have agreed is controlling here, there are three factors The temporal proximity between the illegality.
No, I know what they are. You don't
need
to.
Okay, very good.
I understand the answer.
Two of those three, and I would say that it's important to note that Brown identified the third of those factors, the purpose and flagrancy of the violation, as the most important. Brown also specifically said that Miranda warnings, of course we're talking by analogy here to a confession, but Miranda warnings are an important factor to be sure in determining whether the confession is obtained by exploitation of an illegal arrest. So contrary to appellant's suggestion, the fact that the officers informed appellant he did not have to consent was in fact an important factor in making this attenuation analysis, and appellant's own cases recognize that a voluntary consent can in fact be a sufficient intervening factor. Chavez Villarreal and Santiago are both cases appellant cites that recognize that. So the question is, was there sufficient attenuation? Two of the three Brown prongs strongly support that there was sufficient attenuation. One is that the appellant's right to refuse consent was clearly explained to him, and the second is that this was not a purposeful or flagrant violation, what Brown identified as the most important factor. It was
way over time.
Okay.
We have the rest of your argument, I think. Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Can
I take a minute?
I don't have anything further unless the court has additional questions. Thank you.
Further questions?
No.
I didn't hear what you said.
I said I don't have anything to add unless the court has additional questions in rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Dyer, Mr. Strand, thank you. Case is submitted.